This is Kate Crookemeyer. I'm interviewing Alan Williams at the Chester Granite Works on Thursday, June 28th, 2007. All right. So the quarry has been here how long?
The best we can date it, it was opened in the 1870s. And it was opened by a group of Finns who came here from Quincy, Mass. They were granite cutters in Quincy. And in traveling out to the western part of the state on Route 20, they noticed there was some gray ledges along Route 20 where there were rock cuts. And they knew it was very high quality granite. So they came up into these hills and opened two quarries, two large quarries. One is referred to historically as the Hudson Quarry, and this was referred to as the Bow Quarry. And the dating would be in the 1870s, and in the 1890s, a private railroad was constructed to serve the quarries to bring the granite from these quarries down into the village of Chester, where the finishing plants were.
And the name of this quarry, Bow Quarry, was it B-O-W?
B-O-W-E.
B-O-W-E.
It's referred to in geological books as the Finn Quarry or the Bow Quarry.
Do you know what the name Bow came from?
It was probably a family name of the property, perhaps the farm that preceded the quarry.
And when did your family become involved with the quarry?
My father worked in both of the quarries as a young man, and his first job was in maintenance, and then he ran a what's called a shot saw for the Hudson Chester Quarry. And that was in the village of Chester. He ran and operated the shot saw. And when that company went out of business, he came to this quarry and designed and built a shot saw, steel shot saw, as a subcontractor for the owners of the quarry. And he contracted with the Chester Granite Company to saw all the stone they quarried right here on the premises. And then that only lasted until 1952, and the company burned to the ground, the whole quarry operation burned to the ground. And the following year, my father bought the remaining, what was left of the quarry, the remaining stock of the corporation. And that's where we came into the picture.
Just to back up, a shot saw does what part of the process?
That was the means of sawing of stone has been an evolutionary process, and in the 30s and 40s, stone was sawn with chilled steel shot, and the blade of the saw was a circular blade, and the stone was processed through a stationary circular blade. That's an evolutionary process. Later on, stone was sawed with carborundum, and then more recently with diamonds. But in the era of the heyday of these quarries, the most common way of sawing granite was with chilled steel shot. The need for sawing continues through all these periods, but the abrasive changes with technology.
And so now you're using diamond?
All of our sawing work now is done with manufactured diamonds.
So your father took over the quarry in 53?
In 53.
And at that point, what sort of, what were they sawing?
These quarries, their main product was monuments. And the reason for that is it's a very highly desirable stone because it's of its fine grain. It has a fine, dense, blue-gray grain. And the hand lettering of these old stones was very visible because of the light-dark contrast. It was it's a darker, finer grain than the best-known granite, which is Barry granite. So it was very much in demand, and this was an era when people were spending a lot of money on family memorials. So it was all these quarries produced monuments. Later on, we started producing granite curbing and other landscape products.
In those years, in producing the monuments, was the quarry also doing the lettering or simply producing the block?
Everything. It was very advanced. This was not just a hardscrabble quarry where stone was split. It was cut, polished, lettered, and very, very elaborate memorials came out of these two quarries. And that was also a sign of the times. People were stayed in one area for generation after generation, so the family plot was usually had a very elaborate stone. In some cases, there was iron fencing around the plot. So, but the work was very elaborate work. They would do all the lettering, polishing, everything.
Did people come here to place the order as well, what they wanted, the design?
No, all this work that was being done for small dealerships throughout the Northeast. The market area for this granite was from Maine to Wisconsin. It was shipped by rail out of Chester to dealers, a lot of dealers in Ohio and Pennsylvania, and from my records, a fair number of dealers in Michigan and Wisconsin.
Wow. So the order would come in, and then
right.
It would be
This was wholesale work which was being done for dealerships.
Did that part of the business go into decline at a certain period?
Most quarries in this country experienced changes in the late 40s, early 50s. There were changes in memorialization, and the market has been actually fairly stable since then. It has not expanded, but other uses of granite have expanded tremendously.
So that's when the curbstone came more into play.
Well, it was a means also of fully utilizing what you quarry. The quarrying process is very expensive. So the less desirable stone was still qualified as curbing grade. Building grade is the term used in the trade. And then the most select stock could be used for monuments.
What sort of changes have you seen in the time that you've been involved in terms of what is produced by the quarry or what the demand is?
Well, what's produced by the quarry has a little bit to do with my skills and interests rather than what the market is. I've focused on one-of-a-kind handmade work because that's where my interest lies. In the trade in general, the use of granite is expanding, and granite is very popular in residential construction and in commercial buildings. In markets other than memorial markets, the big sea changes were when we no longer built buildings that were structural masonry buildings. Early on in this country, all public buildings were they didn't have a framework of steel. They were load-bearing masonry walls, and that produced a huge demand for granite. And that a big change took place right around 1900 when structural steel was being used in commercial buildings and with the use of concrete.
So now you're getting granite facings when you're getting granite.
It went from load-bearing walls to more of a cladding. Granite skin.
So when did you get involved with the operation here?
It was a small family business. So growing up, my brother and I were here at the quarry, just like in historically traditional in a family farm. We were here all the time when we were in school. So we learned hands-on from the old cutters who were still here, the Finns that were still carving. And then, you know, my interest ran more toward sculpture and craft. And so when I started my own business, which would have been 1970, I focused more on handwork.
And was that a business that you did in conjunction with the quarry here, or was that somewhere else?
That was my own resurrection of the Chester Granite Company, continuing the history of the company, but doing handwork.
What year were you born?
47.
So you were quite young when your dad took over here.
Yes. We grew up, and it was literally a very small business with a few of the old Finn carvers still working here, and my father and. We We worked right alongside him, running the saws, splitting the stone out down in the quarry, working with the old wooden derricks.
So you saw all parts of the process from
It was a very fortunate thing to have seen the early methods of carving and quarrying. I didn't think it was fortunate at the time.
But you came around. At what point did your view on that shift?
It shifted slowly, but to go on in a trade that you grew up in, you have to reinvent it. You have to make it your own.
And so, who were there people who helped you form your new idea of how to go forward with the more architectural?
Absolutely. My association with one of the early things that happened that influenced me very strongly was my association with the Hancock Shaker Village in Hancock, Mass., because they were just becoming an established museum. And their director, John Ott, at the time, decided he wanted active demonstrations of the early crafts and established a twice-a-year craft festival. And that began in 1976, and for 20 years I participated there as a stone carver, demonstrating lettering and hand splitting and dressing stone. And that influenced me a lot, seeing the way the Shakers, studying the way the Shakers cut stone, and their approach to craft as being very important. Not how many things they made, but how well they were made.
Besides the stone workers, the Finns who were here, and your father, were there other teachers who were particularly important in your learning process? I think I saw somewhere that you had gone to Europe or gone to Ireland.
One of the things that I needed to learn when I started doing restoration work on a lot of public buildings was I knew all the tools and techniques of granite carving, but the earlier buildings we were working on had limestone and brownstone, and the tools are slightly different and the finishes are slightly different. And through traveling in England and Ireland at the time when they were doing a lot of major restoration on their public buildings, I was able to fill in some of the blank spots there in terms of tools and techniques. And through the Early American Industries Association, I was able to track down some of these obscure dressing tools. So now we have all, to the best of my knowledge, about every type of bush hammer, crandle, and hand tool droves and bolsters that were used in the trade, in the soft stone trade as well as the granite trade. So when we do restoration work, we work the same stone with the same tools by hand.
So you figure out what would have been used on that building at
right, and that was a little, I was unfamiliar with the early on with how brownstone and limestone would have been dressed and what produced the finishes that were still visible on the building.
So there are times when you're doing restoration work on other materials that aren't quarried here, and then there are times that you're doing work on your own quarried stone as well.
Correct, and in some cases a lot of these restoration projects involve going to an abandoned quarry site because the stone is not quarried at all, the original stone that was used. But we've had some successes in tracking down where the stone came from and getting permission to bring out stone from an old quarry site to do restoration work.
And so in that case, you're bringing in your equipment to take the stone out, or how does that work?
Right. Well, each case is different. Now, in the case of the restoration work we did for Harvard University, the university tracked down salvage material of the same, in that case it was Nova Scotia sandstone. The university was able to track down pieces, large pieces of salvage stone that we worked from. And in some cases, the brown stone quarry that was used was no longer operating, but in one case the quarry site was on public land and we were able to get permission to go in and bring out blocks that were already quarried.
Your operation now, how many people work here?
Five.
Okay. And does everyone know all parts of the process, or do people specialize in certain aspects of that house?
There's specialization, and the hand-carved lettering I do mostly myself, and the younger fellows do rock pitch work and molding work. So there is specialization, yes.
How have you found people, or how have people come to be involved with?
There were people who came right from the local community that weren't specifically seeking out a granite quarry. All these fellows came to me right from the area, and they had early on realized how special it was to work stone, to learn how to master a very difficult material. And they stayed with me. Sean has been with me for 24 years, and Vic 19 years. So they stayed on. They saw a little bit of what I saw.
So does it seem like when you're ready to give it over, there are people who might want to continue it?
I don't know. There's a lot of interest in stone and stonework. Mm-hmm. I don't think everyone who says they're curious and interested realizes how impossible a task it is. But I don't know. I would like to think there'll always be people carving stone in the traditional way. There'll be some who have an interest in doing that.
You used the word impossible. What's impossible about it?
One of the things is what working granite does to the human body. The tools you use, what it does to your hands. It's very, very unforgiving in terms of just your physically. The pneumatics, what they do to your hands. The dust is extremely dangerous. And then just the material itself does not want to be worked. It's very difficult to craft.
Challenge. What are some of the projects you've done that have been most interesting for you?
Well, that's evolutionary. The work we've done on public buildings, each building poses a new challenge. So in one case, it was a granite church, and we had to carve a new rose window and new Gothic arches for the church. So when you start in on a restoration job, you learn about that building, who built it and when, where the stone came from, the architecture. You get to study the architecture of that building. So each building is very rewarding, and it sends you to the history books. One recent project that's just getting underway is a restoration of two of the Whistler arches on the Boston and Albany Railroad. They're dry-laid stone arches 90 feet off the Westfield River. And we're doing parapet walls and spandrel wall replacement stone for those. And that's quite a story, because they were constructed in the 1840s, prior to air power, all handwork. And very dramatic structures. So each job has its rewards, and each one's different.
So that's 90 feet up that you're replacing?
Right, it's a barrel arch that carried two tracks of the Boston and Albany Railroad, built around 1840.
Is it in use for?
There are seven arches, two of them are still in use.
Are you you're working on ones that are in
the
use?
The ones that
are
out of use are now being made into a hiking trail, and the state is bringing back stabilizing the arches as destination for hikers.
Interesting. So, and are you working with engineers who will help place them, or are you also doing placement?
The actual on-site work will be done by a general contractor. Because of the scale of the operation, there'll be channel wall construction. The river will literally have to be dewatered to stabilize the arches.
Oh, wow. That's pretty neat. Is that something that can be seen from
Yes.
any a vantage point?
Oh yes, there. But, the trail is open. Okay. The historic Chester Arches.
It's over the Westfield River in Chester?
It's between Chester and Middlefield.
Okay. That'd be great to see. excuse me. And so that's one of the major projects you're working on now. What other things
well,
are
a
in
lot
the
of,
pipeline?
A lot of our projects are residential projects. There are growing number of people who are building for extraordinary homes built in the tradition of the new homes, grand new homes being built in stone. The ultimate home is a stone. Our most challenging work right now are actually private residential.
Municipal buildings.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And are those all over, is this mostly in the north?
And we're working on two in Connecticut.
So actually, maybe, I mean, would you mind just kind of walking me through it out there a little bit?
Mm-hmm.
Is it?
But I would love to see it.